Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Three times in 3 years, the global economy has said, nuh-uh, not so fast. Why recovery is turning out to be so darn hard. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 4th of June. Good to have you with us. So, you know, an interesting thing happened on the way to the opening bell on Wall Street this morning. Nothing. No panic selling, not the Dow off 300 points, no nothing. Which, if you remember where we were on Friday, that lousy jobs report and ever-intensifying European angst, came as something of a surprise. It's been, give or take, 8 weeks since we thought we had a real recovery, with the American economy adding 275,000 jobs a month and Europe finally bailed out. Shows what we know, right? So we're going to review today, walk things back a little bit, figure out as best we can how we got from there to here.
Europe, because it's 20% of the world's demand and 20% of the world's GDP.
Uncertainty was a cause of economic instability. That's been true in the past. It's true today.
I think it's karma. We've tried to build a road on quicksand as far as the economy has gone, and we'll continue to see the fallout.
None of that's all that reassuring, I know. So let's talk it through a little bit. You could say this started with Greece, like Ethan Harris does. He's co-head of global economics at Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
Well, Greece is kind of a trigger for a much bigger problem. It is a small world after all, and the mouse that roared is Greece.
There's always politics in these things, the domestic kind in particular. Here's Larry Sabato from the University of Virginia.
Most people would point to Europe, but I don't think the D.C. bunch is doing anything to help. The uncertainty is stemming from tax and spending policies that they're refusing to grapple with now. The sooner they get started, the better. In fact, several months ago would not have been too soon.
There's consumer confidence and maybe Americans not having faith anymore that things could get better. Charles Gabriel's at Capital Alpha Partners in Washington. That's an independent research firm.
Because we have put off until the fall, you know, any serious talk about extending the Bush tax cuts, you've got small businesses that really are loath to really make any serious capital investments or decisions on hiring.
What about China and its economic miracle as a way out? Yeah, that's not helping.
China has really been the bright spot in the global economy the last few years. China's been the engine that's been working. And if China were to slow down dramatically, it'd have a huge impact on trade and growth. This really would be the other shoe dropping.
Harvard economist Ken Rogoff there. And yes, you can't even blame the weather, should you so choose.
I mean, one possible reason is that Wall Street is very attached to its vacations. And so right around this time of year, everyone starts to mentally check out. There's actually a saying on Wall Street, sell in May and go away.
Our New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore, with us today. You can analyze this stuff, though, till you're blue in the face. But at some point, the question does kind of become, how does a whole planet full of people facing recession get out of it? So we got a guy on the phone who knows a little something about international economics. That's what Paul Krugman got his Nobel Prize for. Mr. Krugman, welcome to the program.
Good to be on.
So this is the third year out of three where we've made tiny steps forward and then what seems like big giant steps backward. What's happening? What's going on?
Wow. Well, it's really two things, I think. One is it was never as good as anybody thought. There were not a lot of really solid things driving the economy forward. There's some underlying improvement. Household balance sheets are a little bit better. People have paid down some of their debt. But there was really no strong positive going on in the U.S. economy. And then there's Europe, which is coming apart at the seams very rapidly now. So between the two of those, of course, we're getting a stutter in our own economy and the possibility of something much, much worse if Europe blows up.
What are you more worried about, Europe or our own domestic weakness?
Oh, I mean, in terms of catastrophic risk, it's Europe. Europe is very close to the edge. I mean, this is they've pretty much run out of ways to paper over the problems. They either have to make a fundamental change in policy or We're really talking about the whole nightmare scenario of bank runs and possible breakup of the euro as a currency. So Europe is the scary stuff, and you know, relatively speaking, we're in good shape, but that's not much consolation. And of course, we get at least some of the backwash from their problems.
It sounds like you're chuckling so you don't cry.
Oh yeah, I mean, what can you say? I mean, you've got to, if you don't see the black humor or the gallows humor in all of this, I don't know how you get through it.
If this is the first real global recession, as is being talked about, what do we do? How do we get out of it? Is there a way?
By the way, it's by no means the first. I mean, one of the things that's so infuriating for some of us is that we're following a lot of the script of the 1930s. We've seen this movie before, and the amazing thing is that all of the villains are making the same mistakes that their counterparts did, you know, 80 years ago. So it's the same old thing. So what we should be doing, those governments that can borrow very cheaply, which includes ours, should for the time being be spending more, not less. This is a really good time to fill in the potholes and rehire those school teachers. And the central banks, the Fed, and even more, the European Central Bank, really need to print a lot of money. This is not the time to obsess over inflation. This is the time to worry that if you don't have enough liquidity sloshing around, the whole thing just falls apart.
The counterargument, though, of course, Mr. Krugman, is we just don't have the money and we'd have to make it up out of thin air.
Of course we would be making it up out of thin air. But, you know, if you say we don't have the money, do you mean that we can't borrow? I mean, U.S. government can borrow at the lowest interest rates in history, right?
But not most of the eurozone, pointedly, right?
Well, because they don't have their own money. The problem with lending money to Greece or even to Spain is you're not actually sure what your claim is. You're lending money to a country that may drop out of the euro under pressure of bad policies being imposed upon them, not mostly their own bad policies. A loan to Spain may end up being a loan that was in pesetas, not in euros. And, of course, that makes it very hard for them to raise money. But we're not in that position.
So what do you do if you're a 30-year-old in the United States with a brand new law degree, or my mom, a retiree widow? I mean, what do you do?
Wow. Well, the trouble is I can't in any good conscience tell people, well, you know, you should go out there and spend and eat, drink, and be merry because that'll help the economy. You have to take care of your own needs first, but we've got a situation now where everyone doing what is individually sensible collectively adds up to a big problem, which is why we have governments. They're supposed to solve problems like this.
Paul Krugman, his most recent book is called End This Depression Now. Mr. Krugman, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
As I said up top, nothing dramatic on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, you know the drill. There's no tension left in the race for the Republican presidential nomination. Hasn't been for a while now. So if it weren't for the state of Wisconsin, there wouldn't be much to pay attention to in tomorrow's last major round of primaries. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is up against a much publicized recall election after he changed collective bargaining rights for public employees last year. Among those employees, some now disgruntled police, firefighters, and corrections officers. WBEZ's Nyla Boudou reports now from Madison.
This sing-along happens at the Capitol building in Madison almost every workday. It grew out of the biggest protest that started last year. Inside today's crowd, like many days, there are a few off-duty firefighters and police officers, including Madison Police Detective Brian Austin, who's actively working to vote Governor Walker out of office.
What this guy did is he came in and basically said, you don't have a voice. You are servants of your employer, and you don't have a voice at the table anymore. And that's not what those do not reflect the values of our state.
Basically, these days, when Austin's not on duty, he's working on the recall. Austin said he's never been this politically active. Jim Palmer says the governor's actions have created a whole new level of activism among rank-and-file police officers. He's the executive director of the state's largest police union.
If you'd have told me a year ago that, you know, we'd be able to get, you know, 200 to 300 law enforcement officers to protest the Capitol or to conduct a sleep-in to prohibit or prevent the Capitol from being closed down, I would have said you were crazy.
The funny thing is, Walker never intended to have police and firefighters against him. When he wrote the laws last year, public safety workers were deliberately excluded from what was basically a dismantling of the state workers' union. The changes forced state employees to contribute more towards pension and health care costs. Then, last summer, when the state budget passed, it had language that gave cities leeway to force those same changes on public safety workers. And now there are a slew of lawsuits across Wisconsin over police officer pay.
And I always say Scott Walker's the best galvanizer ever.
That's Maylin Mitchell. He's the head of the state firefighters union, and tomorrow he may become the next lieutenant governor. Mitchell's also a firefighter in Madison. He told me he always intended to spend his entire life as one. Mitchell says Walker's changed that, not just for him, but for many of his coworkers.
And speaking from a firefighter standpoint, we talked about three or four different issues. I always say it's the gays, guns, and God. Well, they realize that it doesn't matter about those social issues right now. Let's vote on issues that really affect our pocketbooks, that affect our hours, affect our wages, and affect our working conditions.
Mitchell likes to point out that in the 2010 election, nearly a third of union members voted for Governor Walker. Paul Wright was one of those voters, but he thinks the governor
turned around and stabbed us right in the back.
Wright's been a state correctional officer for 24 years, and for the past year, he's made about $900 less a month because of how much more he pays towards pension contributions and health care.
That would be a nice truck payment. You could buy a house with $900 a month.
Wright says that $900 means his son can only afford to attend community college instead of the University of Wisconsin. The day we spoke, Wright had on a Green Bay Packers sweatshirt, but he pulled it up to show me a red Recall Walker t-shirt underneath. He has five of those t-shirts, so he can wear one every day of the week. In Madison, Wisconsin, I'm Nyla Boodoo for Marketplace.
Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee celebrations, 60 years on the throne, continue should you have missed the 1,000-boat flotilla on the River Thames yesterday. The Queen's throwing a garden party tonight, complete with a concert outside Buckingham Palace. Paul McCartney, Stevie Wonder, and Elton John are just some of the stars set to perform. How all that partying's going over at a time of austerity in the UK, though? Christopher Worth has that story from London.
It's not always pretty, but it's pretty much everywhere in London right now. The strains of the British national anthem reaching every corner of the capital. An estimated 1 million people came here yesterday to watch the Queen float by. To recover, the entire country has an extra day off today. David Kern, an economist with the British Chambers of Commerce, says that's going to hurt the British economy.
In the current quarter, growth will be flat.
Extra days off are projected to cost the country as much as $3.5 billion. But Justin Urquhart Stewart of Seven Investment Management says that doesn't take into account the benefits of a little merrymaking.
We tend to forget that holidays do have a very positive impact on productivity.
People feel good, he says, and they go spend a little money. The Queen's Jubilee is expected to give hotels and other tourism industries a $1.4 billion boost. Londoner Nigel Hutchinson is celebrating and says he's happy to do his part.
In times of recession, we actually need some enjoyment in our lives. So I would say, long live Great Britain, long live Queen Elizabeth, long live the great British monarchy.
But not everyone feels that way. Several hundred people turned out in London yesterday to protest a royal family that cost taxpayers about $49 million a year. Anti-royalist Louise Radici.
At a time when there's a growing gap between rich and poor, it is outrageous. If the royal family paid their fair share of taxes, there wouldn't be the growing number of poor that we have in this country now.
Radici says instead of a queen, she'd like to vote for a democratically elected president, just like people do in the United States. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Coming up, you want to feed the world? Yeah, it's a pretty simple proposition.
For farmers, it all comes down to the dirt.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, continues. But first, Let's do the numbers. Wall Street was all over the place before settling about where it started today. The Dow Industrial slipped 17 points, about a 10%, 12,101 the number. The NASDAQ added 12 points, 0.4%, finished at 2760. The S&P 500 ended things flat, 1278 at the bell. Weak manufacturing numbers and fears of a global economic slowdown hit equipment maker Caterpillar. Investors dug a hole of 2.2% for the multinational shares. Delta Airlines reported weaker than expected passenger numbers for May. Shares of Delta and U.S. Airways each fell 11.5% today. An embattled company we've been telling you about recently made a comeback. Chesapeake Energy shares surged 6% after agreeing to appoint four independent directors to its board. Another big gainer was Concur Technologies, the software firm which many of you, yours truly included, might know from filing expenses. Won a big contract to manage a travel system for the federal government. Stocks inked up nearly 7% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee discusses combating poverty, understanding new challenges for families. The planet Venus is going to make a trek across the sun. This is your last chance to see it until the year 2117. NASA holds a web chat and live webcast. And back on planet Earth, the United Nations marks World Environment Day. The 2012 theme, Green Economy. Does it include you? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Big day in Portugal today, if you're into those kinds of things. They're going to get the next slice of their bailout money. After all, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission, the Troika in the vernacular, said Lisbon is doing the austerity thing pretty much right. Figuring out what that actually means, though, gets us to the latest installment of
What's Up?
What's Up?
What's Up, Europe?
Today with Alison Roberts. She's the BBC's Portugal correspondent in Lisbon. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder what it's like being in a country that has had its share of budget and debt problems and yet is now out of the limelight, right? I mean, you're right next door to Spain where so much attention is focused and Greece. Is this something that is part of the daily conversation?
Well, the spotlight in Portugal is on Greece. It's rather bizarre because a few years ago, you didn't really hear that much about Greece in Portugal. And now you hear about it all the time. And that's partly because the Portuguese are worried that they're going to be, quote, another Greece, unquote. And the Portuguese really, for the most part, are really just getting by. And when everything seems to be going up in price and you can see your own income being squeezed and no prospect of any decent pay rises in the near future. You know, really, a lot of people are just focusing on that.
When Portuguese want to not think about all the bad economic news, what do they do? I mean, what happens? What passes for fun nowadays?
Well, the other thing that is dominating the news bulletins at the moment, as it very often does in Portugal, is soccer. We have the European Championships coming up just at the weekend, just at the moment when people might be hoping that stars like Cristiano Ronaldo, one of the most famous soccer players in the world, might be giving them a little bit of a lift. Things aren't looking so good at the moment. And not to mention the fact that on Saturday, Portugal's first game is against who else but Germany?
Oh, gosh. Alison Roberts in Lisbon, thank you.
You're welcome.
We've been working on a big population and food project for the past half year or so, geared around this question. With the United Nations saying there are going to be 9 billion people on the planet by the middle of the century, how are we going to feed them all? In Africa right now, a continent with one of the world's fastest growing populations, a lot of farmers work the same way their ancestors did. No fertilizers or improved seeds, no fancy machinery or sophisticated irrigation systems. And yet, they're going to have to double the amount of food they produce by 2050. So today on our series, Food for 9 Billion, Jory Lewis went to Ghana to figure out how they might do that.
For farmers, it all comes down to the dirt. I've come to Kumasi in central Ghana to visit the Soil Research Institute. Ghana sits due south of Spain, Morocco, and Mali, and right now is West Africa's superstar. After discovering some 3 billion barrels of oil in 2007, Ghana's economy went into overdrive. In 2011, it was the world's fastest-growing economy. It has one of the fastest-growing populations, too, more than 20 million now. Kumasi is in the Ashanti region, where rolling hills and forests support corn and yam, cocoa and coffee. In the years to come, these hills will need to produce more than ever before. Dr. Francis Tete from the Soil Research Institute is standing on the side of one of those hills now, showing me a deep pit. He's uncovering the secrets of the dirt itself.
There are two main kinds of soils in the whole of Ashanti region. This area you see here has the two groups coming together.
He says that for thousands of years, subsistence farmers have been taking nutrients out of the soil and not putting them back. In effect, farmers are mining the soil. And this is a problem all over Africa. The nutrients are gone and the soil can't produce. Not far from the Soil Research Institute, I find the tiny village of Fufuo. It's a town full of red dirt and red buildings. Farmers here traditionally practice shifting cultivation, meaning they clear the forest, farm till the dirt is exhausted, and then move on. In the 1980s, a development project brought things the farmers had never had before. Improved corn seeds, fertilizers, and herbicides. This changed everything. Bigger corn, bigger harvests, and more money. But once that project ended, farmers still couldn't afford fertilizers on their own. Even today, with the Ghanaian government subsidizing fertilizer prices, the cost is still too much. Agronomist Kofi Boa said that fertilizer is sometimes necessary, but not always. What farmers need are better ways to manage the soil. Boa is a devotee of what's called no-till farming, where farmers simply leave all the unused parts of crops to decompose on the field. That makes a mulch that keeps moisture in and adds back nutrients. The soil stays covered and is restored by nature.
You see here, you can really sense life. Unlike here, you don't see anything here, but when you come here, wherever you have the mulch, you see this one, and this is telling you that there is an activity.
But no-till has a downside. Weeds like you wouldn't believe. Enter agrochemical company Monsanto. It sells farmers an herbicide to kill those weeds, an herbicide called glyphosate, better known as Roundup. On the road, we pass men in protective boots and gloves with chemical cans on their backs and sprayers in their hands. Boa says the secret to no-till farming's adoption in Ghana was actually glyphosate, and that, eventually, the product took over.
Having the glyphosate available meant that farmers could just have it easy. If the whole thing is just about killing weed and not caring about having the mulch, then it defeats the purpose of whatever we set out to do.
Boa says no-till systems also need cover crops to prevent erosion and other plants to deliver more nutrients to the soil. But all that has been a harder sell to Ghanaian farmers than glyphosate and fertilizer. After all, why let the dirt rest and recharge when chemicals can help it produce without interruption? Across the country, in the northern regions of Ghana, small farmers are looking for different solutions because they want and need to. In the north, the savanna stretches out dry and flat, and the rains come just once a year. Farmers can't afford a lot of fertilizers, herbicides, and improved seeds, so they manage their entire farms from water to waste streams and make use of everything. In a northern Dagamba village, I meet farmer Richard Dahaman. He invites me to share a typical midday meal, rice in a sauce made from peanut butter. Dahaman shows me around his house and fields. He shows me his rainwater tank, where his 30 sheep sleep, and where he collects the sheep droppings, which allow him to cut back on fertilizer. And best of all, it's working for him. He said that before, he wasn't doing much and wasn't making much money either.
I was alone, a bachelor. Even the money I was getting wasn't enough for me. And now I have a family.
Now, his yields and his money have increased. He's sending his children to school and adding on to his house. But Kofi Boa says this practice takes a lot of work. And it will never be as easy as simply buying fertilizer and glyphosate. And as farmers are more successful, There's no way to keep them from switching to what's easy.
For me, I surely would want to see every African government paying a lot of attention to sustainable cropping systems. And people should not just pay lip service because it's mandatory for them to talk about it. Governments have to be committed.
He dreams of a day when governments will subsidize compost as well as fertilizer, when enterprising farmers plant cover crops to go along with their hybrid corn, when people recognize that to feed as many as we're going to need to, soil matters just as much as the crop. In Ghana, I'm Jory Lewis for Marketplace.
Our series, Food for 9 Billion, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions, the Center for Investigative Reporting, and a PBS NewsHour. There's much more about exactly how we're going to feed all those people on our website, marketplace.org. We're on Facebook, too.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation about U.S. government debt now that interest rates on the 10-year are the lowest they've ever been. You know how we always talk about foreigners, China especially, being the ones who hold all of our debt? Not true at all. We saw an item on CNBC's website today listing the top 15 buyers of treasuries. There is China, of course, at number 3, Japan at number 5, and that's it for countries in the top 10. The biggest holder of U.S. debt overall, the Social Security Trust Fund. Number 2, any guesses? Come on, think about it. All right, it's the Federal Reserve. Can you say quantitative easing? Numbers 1, 2, and maybe 3, who knows? All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.